Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I want to read the major news articles from the Monday, January 5th, 2026 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather, partly cloudy, highs to 66 degrees Fahrenheit, winds light and variable. Tonight's weather, some clouds, lows to 44 degrees Fahrenheit, winds light and variable, and tomorrow's forecast predicts sunshine and clouds mixed. Highs to 67 degrees Fahrenheit, winds east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. And now from the Arizona Daily Star front page, we'll read the first article titled, Trump, U.S. will run Venezuela. This article was written by Regina Garcia Cano, Constantine Toropin, and Eric Tucker, all of the Associated Press, Dateline Caracas, Venezuela. Deposed Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro arrived in the United States to face criminal charges after being captured in an audacious nighttime military operation that President Donald Trump said would set the U.S. up to run the South American country and tap its vast oil reserves to sell to other nations. Maduro landed late Saturday afternoon at a small airport in New York following the middle-of-the-night operation that extracted him and his wife, Celia Flores, from their home in a military base in the capital, Caracas, an act that Maduro's government called imperialist. The couple faces U.S. charges of participating in a narco-terrorism conspiracy. The dramatic action capped an intensive Trump administration pressure campaign to Venezuela's autocratic leader and months of secret planning, resulting in the most assertive American action to achieve regime change since the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Legal experts raised questions about the lawfulness of the operation, which was done without congressional approval. Venezuela's Vice President Delcy Rodriguez, meanwhile, demanded that the United States free Maduro and called him the country's rightful leader, as her nation's high court named her interim president. Some Venezuelan civilians and members of the military were killed, said Rodriguez, who didn't give a number. Trump said some U.S. forces were injured, but none was killed. Speaking to reporters hours after the Maduro capture, Trump revealed his plans to exploit the leadership void to fix the country's oil infrastructure and sell large amounts of oil to other countries. After arriving at a small airport in New York City's northern suburbs, Maduro was flown by helicopter to Manhattan, where a convoy of law enforcement vehicles, including an armored car, was waiting to whisk him to a nearby U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration office. A video posted on social media by a White House account showed Maduro smiling as he was escorted through that office by two DEA agents grasping his arms. The Trump administration promoted the ouster as a step towards reducing the flow of dangerous drugs into the United States. The president touted what he saw as other potential benefits, including a leadership stake in the country and greater control of oil. Trump claimed the U.S. government would help lead the country and was already doing so, though there were no immediate visible signs of that. Venezuelan state TV aired pro-Maduro propaganda and broadcast live images of supporters taking the streets in Caracas in protest. We're going to run the country until such time as we can do a safe, proper, and judicious transition, Trump said at a Mar-a-Lago news conference. He boasted that this extremely successful operation should serve as warning to anyone who would threaten American sovereignty or endanger American lives. Maduro and other Venezuelan officials were indicted in 2020 on narco-terrorism conspiracy charges, and the Justice Department released a new indictment Saturday of Maduro and his wife that painted his administration as a corrupt, illegitimate government fueled by a drug trafficking operation that flooded the U.S. with cocaine. The U.S. government does not recognize Maduro as the country's leader. The Trump administration spent months building up American forces in the region and carrying out attacks on boats in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific Ocean for allegedly ferrying drugs. Last week, the CIA was behind a drone strike at a docking area believed to have been used by Venezuelan drug cartels and first known direct operation on Venezuelan soil since the U.S. campaign began in September. Taking place 36 years after the day after the 1990 surrender and seizure of Panama Canal leader Manuel Antonio Noriega, following a U.S. invasion, the Venezuela operation unfolded under the cover of darkness early Saturday. Trump said the U.S. turned off almost all of the lights in Caracas while forces moved in to extract Maduro and his wife. General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said U.S. forces had rehearsed their maneuvers for months, learning everything about Maduro, where he was and what he ate, as well as details of his pets and his clothes. "We think, we develop, we train, we rehearse, we debrief, we rehearse again and again," Kane said. "Not to get it right, but to ensure we cannot get it wrong." Multiple explosions rang out that morning and low-flying aircraft swept through Caracas. Maduro's government accused the United States of hitting civilian and military installations, calling it an imperialistic attack, and urging citizens to take to the streets. The explosions, at least 7 blasts, sent people rushing into the streets, while others took to social media to report what they saw and heard. Restrictions imposed by the United States government on airspace around Venezuela and the Caribbean expired early Sunday. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said on X, an announcement that suggested any further immediate major U.S. military action was unlikely. "Airlines are informed and will update their schedules quickly," he posted. Under Venezuelan law, Rodriguez would take over from Maduro. Rodriguez, however, stressed during a Saturday appearance on state television that she did not plan to assume power before Venezuela's high court ordered that she become interim president. "There is only one president in Venezuela," Rodriguez said, "and his name is Nicolas Maduro Moros." Venezuela's ruling party has held power since 1999 when Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, took office, promising to uplift poor people and later to implement a self-described socialist revolution. Maduro took over when Chavez died in 2013. His 2018 re-election was widely considered a sham because the main opposition parties were banned from participating. During the 2024 edition, electoral authorities loyal to the ruling party declared him the winner hours after polls closed, but the opposition gathered overwhelming evidence that he lost by a more than 2-to-1 margin. Venezuela's capital remained unusually quiet Sunday, with few vehicles moving around and convenience stores, gas stations, and other businesses closed. A road typically filled with runners, cyclists, and other fitness enthusiasts on Sunday only had a handful of people working out the day after Maduro was deposed. The presidential palace was guarded by armed civilians and members of the military. At a nearby plaza, only a street sweeper and a soldier stood, and across the street, a church remained closed for a second day in a row. Caracas resident David Leal arrived to the lot where he parks vehicles for a living, only to quickly realize that he would likely not see any clients for a second day. "People are still shaken," Leal, 77, said. Whether the United States violated any laws, international or otherwise, was still a question early Sunday. There are a number of international legal concepts which the United States might have broken by capturing Maduro, said Ilan Cutts, an international law analyst. Pope Leo XIV, who last month had expressed concern about growing U.S. threats of military intervention in Venezuela, raised alarm during his Sunday noon blessing and said the good of the Venezuelan people must prevail above everything else. History's first U.S. pope demanded an end to violence and for Venezuela's sovereignty to be guaranteed. In New York, the U.N. Security Council acted on an emergency request from Colombia, planned to hold a meeting on U.S. operations in Venezuela on Monday morning. Lawmakers from both American political parties have raised reservations and flat out objections to the U.S. attacks on boats suspected of drug smuggling. Congress has not approved an authorization for the use of military force for such operations in the region. Connecticut Representative Jim Himes, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, said he had seen no evidence that would justify Trump striking Venezuela without approval from Congress and demanded an immediate briefing by the administration on its plan to ensure stability in the region and its legal justification for this decision. The next front page article is titled, Bill Would Ban Burgers for EBT. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. Dateline Phoenix, an elderly, disabled, or homeless should be unable to use their food stamps at McDonald's, no matter what the federal law allows, an Arizona lawmaker says. Ditto, Jack in the Box, Carl's Jr., or Subway. Representative Teresa Martinez, a Casa Grande Republican, acknowledged that federal law allows an exception to the general prohibition against such purchases under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program for those who fit one of those categories. Instead, it permits states to allow those who are eligible to use their electronic benefit transfer cards at fast food restaurants and only those that have been approved by the states to get meals there. What's behind that, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, is providing an option for those who may not be able to prepare meals for themselves or may not have permanent housing or storing or preparing food. Arizona opted into the program in 2007, and the Department of Economic Security, which administers the federally funded food stamp program, says that the most recent data shows about 25,200 households qualify for using their benefits at participating restaurants. That is about 7.2% of all households that are getting SNAP benefits. Martinez, however, wants Arizona out of the program, and that's why her HB 2107 would make it happen. On one hand, Martinez says she understands what's behind it. What's a homeless man going to do with 5 pounds or 2 pounds of raw beef or raw chicken, she asked. But Martinez said there are other choices. Consider, she said, it can cost $8 more to buy a Big Mac, especially if you add on fries and soda. For $8 at a grocery store, a homeless person, anybody can buy a loaf of bread, a pack of bologna, and some cheese, Martinez said, and that will last them a week. And if that's not an option, she said, someone with an EBT card can just as easily walk into a convenience store and buy a pre-made sandwich. I'm not trying to punish the homeless people, Martinez said. Instead, Martinez said she wants them and others to make smarter decisions, both from a financial and health standpoint, especially as they are buying their food with tax dollars. Martinez said she's not preaching what she has not done herself. I was on food on stamps many, many years ago, she said. I wasn't on them for very long, Martinez continued, and I went to the grocery store and made every dollar count. And her objections are not just about money. It's not nutritious, she said. But some who advocate for affected groups say it's not that simple. We do say the policymakers should ensure that recipients of food benefits have access to healthy diets, said Dana Kennedy. She is the state director for AARP. That includes recipients who have limited or no capacity to buy, prepare, or store food, Kennedy said. She also said if the concern is nutrition, there are ways to encourage healthy eatings without unreasonably restricting food choice. Kennedy said that what is considered fast food is defined by the restaurants that are allowed to accept food stamps, but she pointed out that there are healthier options available. Most now offer a salad and yogurt, Kennedy said. There's another consideration that could have particular impact on the homeless. If they bought packages of bologna and cheese, that summer heat could make it impractical to keep it for any period of time. Even if there is a legitimate reason to let the elderly, disabled, and homeless use food stamps at fast food restaurants, a point she's not conceding, Martinez said she's not sure they are the only ones buying burgers and fries. She said she's convinced that some of the restaurants are not checking to ensure that those using food stamps fit the eligibility criteria. Her proof, the signs on the participating restaurant saying, EBT accepted here. It doesn't give the impression that it's only for certain types of EBT cards, she said. I believe in my heart of hearts that the majority of SNAP payments that McDonald's and Jack in the Box are getting are from regular folks who use SNAP who have homes. That, however, appears to be precluded by requirements set out by USDA. They say that SNAP recipients who are eligible will have an electronic benefit transfer card that is coded to allow them to be accepted at participating restaurants, and that EBT cards without that coding automatically will be declined. Still, Martinez said there is at least a public perception problem. I just think the taxpayer who funds the SNAP program gets frustrated when they see people using a SNAP card and they've got the latest iPhone and they've got their hair done and they've got their nails done and they're getting into a nicer car than the taxpayer, she said. And we've all seen that happen, Martinez says. I'm sure it's very frustrating for people to say, well, here's a family of five and they're using SNAP benefits and so I'm paying not only for my Big Mac, but I'm paying for their Big Mac too. That requirement for fast food restaurants has to be set up with an electronic EBT terminal, one that can differentiate between those who are entitled to shop there and those who are not. Also means that residents of some communities don't have as broad an option as others. This is an opt-in system, and not every fast food restaurant chooses to participate. For example, DES lists 80 sites in Mesa with a variety ranging from Burger King to Del Taco to Firehouse Subs, Rally's Hamburgers, and Subway. Tucson has 58, including some of the regular fast food places, as well as Wiener Schnitzel and Ying Yang Express. But there are just three places that accept EBT cards in Green Valley, two in Chino Valley, and only a single Burger King on Naco Highway in Bisbee. Martinez is not alone in her bid to restrict food stamp purchases. Representative Leo Biascucci crafted a plan last year to ban the purchase of sodas and junk food. The Lake Havasu City Republican had to strip out the second part of that after conceding that this definition was so broad that it put health and granola bars in the same categories as candy bars. He did get the legislature to approve the ban on sodas, only to have it vetoed by Governor Katie Hobbs, who said it deprives SNAP recipients of purchasing power and relegates them to a new underclass of grocery shoppers. Instead, the governor, who said she too once was a food stamp recipient, said lawmakers should focus their attention not on legally limiting what people can buy, but instead on more productive efforts to expand opportunities for participants to purchase fresh foods. Biascucci said he is trying to craft a new approach this year, one that would limit food stamp purchases to what now can be bought by pregnant women, new mothers, and their offspring in the Women's, Infants, and Children's program. He called them the essentials, including fruit, vegetables, milk, baby formula, and food and cereals. All this comes as effective January 1st, Indiana, Iowa, Nebraska, Utah, and West Virginia imposed their own restrictions on what can be bought with SNAP benefits after being granted permission by USDA, mostly banning soda purchases. And 13 other states will impose their own limits later this year. The next front page article is titled Struggles Linger for J6 Officers. This article was written by Mary Claire Jelonek of the Associated Press, Dateline Washington. As Donald Trump was inaugurated for the second time on January 20, 2025, former Capitol Police Sergeant Aquilino Cornell put his phone on Do Not Disturb and left it on his nightstand to take a break from the news. That evening, after Cornell spent time with family and took his dog for a long walk, his phone started to blow up with calls. He had messages from federal prosecutors, FBI agents, and the Federal Bureau of Prisons, all letting him know that the new president had just pardoned about 1,500 people who had been convicted for their actions on the Capitol on January 6, 2021. The pardons included rioters who had injured Cornell as he and other officers tried to protect the building. They told me that people I testified against were being released from prison, Cornell said, and to be mindful. Cornell was one of the officers who defended the central west front entrance to the Capitol that day, as Congress was certifying Democrat Joe Biden's victory, and hundreds of Trump supporters broke into the building, echoing his false claims of a stolen election. Cornell was dragged into the crowd by his shoulder straps as he tried to fight people off. He almost suffocated. In court, he testified about injuries to his shoulder and foot that still bother him to this day. They have tried to erase what I did with pardons and other attempts to play down the violent attack, Cornell said. I lost my career, my health, and I have been trying to get my life back. 5 years since the siege, Gonel and some of the other police officers who fought off the rioters are still coming to terms with what happened, especially after Trump was decisively elected to a second term last year and granted those pardons. Their struggle has been compounded by statements from the Republican president and some lawmakers in Congress minimizing the violence that the officers encountered. "It's been a difficult year," said Officer Daniel Hodges, a Metropolitan Police Department officer who was also injured as he fought near Gonel in a tunnel on the West Front. Hodges was attacked several times, crushed by the rioters between heavy doors, and beaten in the head as he screamed for help. "A lot of things are getting worse," Hodges said. More than 140 police officers were injured during the fighting on January 6, which turned increasingly brutal as the hours wore on. Former Capitol Police Chief Thomas Manger took over from the department 6 months after the riot. He said in a recent interview that many of his officers were angry when he first arrived, not only because of injuries they suffered, but also they resented the fact that they didn't have the equipment they needed, the training they needed to deal with the unexpectedly violent crowd. Several officers who fought the rioters told the Associated Press that the hardest thing to deal with has been the effort by many to play down the violence despite a massive trove of video and photographic evidence documenting the carnage. Trump has called the rioters he pardoned, including those who are the most violent towards the police, patriots and hostages. He called their convictions for harming the officers and breaking into the building a grave national injustice. "I think that was wrong," Adam Evelyn, that former District of Columbia police officer, said of Trump's pardons. "If there were to be pardons," Evelyn said, "Trump's administration should have reviewed every case." "I've had a hard time processing that," said Evelyn, who fought the rioters and helped push them off the Capitol grounds. "The pardons erased what little justice there was," he said. Former Capitol police officer Winston Pigeon, who was part of the force's civil disturbance unit on January 6. He left the force several months afterwards. Hodges and Gonel have been speaking out about their experiences since July 2021, when they testified before the Democratic-led House committee that investigated January 6. Since then, they have received support but also backlash. At a Republican-led Senate hearing in October on political violence, Hodges testified again as a witness called by Democrats. After Hodges spoke about his experience on January 6, Senator Peter Welch, Democrat of Vermont, asked the other witnesses whether they supported Trump's pardons of the rioters, including those who injured Hodges. Three of the witnesses, all called by Republicans, raised their hands. "I don't know how you would say that it wasn't violence," says Hodges, who is still a Washington police officer. "It has not just been politicians or the rioters who have doubted the police. It's also friends and family. My biggest struggle through the years has been the public perception of it," Evelyn said. In navigating conversations with public, or rather with people close to him, including some fellow police officers who do not think it was a big deal. "It's hard for me to wrap my head around that, but ideologically, it is a pretty powerful thing," he said. As police officers struggled in the aftermath, Manger, the former Capitol Police Chief, said the department had to figure out how to better support them. "There were no witnesses or counseling services when he arrived," he said, "and they were put into place. The officers who were there and were in the fight, we needed to make sure that they got the help that they needed," Manger said. Manger, who retired in May, also oversaw major improvements in the department's training, equipment, operational planning, and intelligence. He said the Capitol is now a great deal safer than it was when he arrived. "If that exact same thing happened again, they would have never breached the building. They would have never gotten inside. They would have never disrupted the electoral count," Manger said. Pigeon, the former Capitol police officer, said he believes the department is in many ways unrecognizable from what it was on January 6 and when he left several months later. "It was a wake-up call," he said. Pigeon, who was attacked and knocked to the ground as he tried to prevent people from entering the Capitol, said January 6 was part of the reason he left the apartment and moved home to Massachusetts. He has dealt with the experience by painting images of the Capitol and his time there, as well as advocating for nonviolence. He said he now feels ready to forgive the real trauma and heartache and everything I endured because of those events. I want to move past it, he said. Gonnell left the Capitol Police because of his injuries. He has not returned to service, though he hopes to work again. He wrote a book about his experience, and he said he still has post-traumatic stress disorder related to the attack. While many of the officers who were there have stayed quiet about their experience, Evelyn said he decided that it was important to talk publicly about January 6th to try to reach people and come at it from a logical standpoint. Still, he said, I've had to come to terms with the fact that just because something happened to me and was a major part of my world doesn't mean that everyone else has to understand that or even be sympathetic to that. He added, the only thing I can do is tell my story, and hopefully the people who respect me will eventually listen. The next item is titled, States Working on Medical Debt Protections. This article was written by Ray Allen Bichel of the KFF Health News. Lawmakers in several states are working to expand medical debt protections for patients even after the Trump administration reversed course and told states they don't have the authority to take action on credit reporting. In Alaska and Michigan, legislators are nonetheless advancing bills to keep medical debt off consumer credit reports. The Attorney General of California and Colorado said they would stand behind credit reporting laws enacted in those states in recent years, even as Colorado faces a lawsuit from debt collectors contesting such laws. Indiana and Ohio lawmakers have dropped proposals to remove medical debt from credit reports, but are pushing legislation that would extend the other protections to patients who cannot pay their medical bills. An estimated 100 million Americans are saddled with healthcare debt, and a growing number of red and blue states have enacted laws to protect patients. But federal policy on such debt boomeranged this year when President Donald Trump's administration chose not to defend federal regulation that would have removed medical debt from all Americans' credit scores. And in October, Trump's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau said states do not have the authority to regulate consumer credit reports. The CFPB did not respond to requests for comment. 8 days after the new federal guidance, the debt collectors filed a lawsuit contesting Colorado's 2023 medical debt credit reporting law, the first to require removal of some or all medical debt from credit reports. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser, a Democrat, called the lawsuit outrageous in a statement to KFF Health News. His office, he said, will strongly oppose all efforts to strip away critical medical debt protections. In other states still contemplating credit reporting laws, legislators are adjusting their strategy to account for the lawsuit, and the Trump administration's moves by either ditching the plan to remove medical debt from credit reports or modifying such legislation. Chi Wu, an attorney with the National Consumer Law Center, which advocates for people with low income, said her organization saw the federal change coming and had already urged state lawmakers to make pending legislation on credit reporting more lawsuit-proof by looking upstream and downstream of the credit reporting agencies. For example, Wu said states can tell landlords, employers, or other credit reporting report users that they cannot use a person's medical debt history in their decision-making. And states can require health providers to include in their contracts with debt collectors limits on what they can tell credit reporting agencies about the bills they are collecting. Alaska's legislation has both elements. It bars landlords from making decisions about potential renters based on their medical debt history, and it bars providers and collectors from telling credit reporting agencies about patient debt. Elsewhere, state lawmakers have opted out of trying to pass credit reporting provisions in proposed legislation. Indiana State Senator Fatty Kudura, a Democrat, filed a medical debt measure that tries to cap interest rates limit wage garnishment, and keep people from losing their homes over unpaid bills from medically necessary procedures, but he and his colleagues made the tactical decision to leave out credit reporting after unsuccessfully including it in a similar bill last year. We'll pause now to remind you that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shandon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles there. The title of the first article is Rent is Major Concern of Poor. This article was written by Piranha Sanapanavar of the Arizona Daily Star. University of Arizona students who interviewed 117 low-income residents across Pima County found that 76% of them are severely burdened by housing costs, which means they spend more than 50% of their income on rent. The students presented their findings on these and other poverty-related issues at a recent community forum. They were taking part in a 10-year-old program, Poverty in Tucson Field Workshop, part of the Tucson Poverty Project in the University School of Sociology in the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences. In 2025, a cohort of 37 students conducted more than 280 interviews with low-income residents. At the time of the interviews, 117 respondents were living below the poverty line, with 49 reporting extreme poverty, defined as income less than 50% of the poverty line for the household size. The students' research showed that the federal government shutdown in the fall increased financial strain because of the 55% of the interviewees were dependent on food subsidies through the U.S.-funded SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The 2025 workshop was only 2 weeks into our data collection when the federal government shutdown led to the disruption of essential social services, including SNAP, said Brian Mayer, a professor of sociology and director of the Tucson Poverty Project. For the households we interviewed, this was both a major source of stress and anxiety as well as a direct impact on their ability to put food on the table. Rising food prices added to that pressure, with 82% reporting higher grocery costs over the past year. Rebecca Orsu, a political science major from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, said in a UA news release that she found through the research that many residents facing food insecurities are unable to access local food banks because of transportation barriers. During the interview, some respondents talked about bus distances and schedules not aligning with food bank hours. One recommendation I think could help is using mobile markets, Ursul said. We have to bring resources to those who need them most. Sophia Hartel, Ursul's teammate on the project, said she was most surprised to find that food insecurity affected residents across economic spectrums, adding that she interviewed people who were fully employed and still couldn't afford food. In terms of housing, data from the workshop showed that affordable housing is a key challenge every year. In many cases, respondents reported rent increases of $100 to $600, forcing families to make difficult choices between housing and essentials such as groceries, medicine, and healthcare, the UA news release said. Data show that housing instability is driven by factors including evictions, unsafe living conditions, and sudden cost increases, and that emergency rental assistance, home repair grants, and rebates are important short-term supports, while closing wage gaps is essential for long-term housing stability, the project reported. The data also showed to worry about losing health coverage was widespread. About 72% of residents interviewed were concerned they will lose health coverage, and more than half of the respondents were very concerned about potential Medicaid cuts. As a takeaway, Ursul said it is important for policymakers to find people-centered options solutions and meet low-income people where they were at. The next item is titled State Republican Leaders Praise Action on Maduro. This article was written by Laura Gorsoni of the Arizona Republic. Arizona Republican congressmen rallied around President Donald Trump's overthrow of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, applauding the gambit as a law enforcement operation. Arizona's GOP representatives offered an unadulterated praise for the attack, criticizing Maduro as a thug, brutal oppressor, and illegitimate dictator. The operation in Venezuela is a reminder that President Trump leads with resolve and will never hesitate to do what he thinks is best for American citizens, wrote Representative Andy Biggs, a Republican who is also running for governor of Arizona with the president's endorsement. Republican Representatives David Schweikert and Paul Gosar called Maduro a drug dealer and narco-tyrant. Representative Aid Hamade called the Venezuelan president an illegitimate ruler who has lost at the ballot box and now clings to power through violence, corruption, and the narcotics trade that has poisoned American communities. The action sends a clear signal that the United States will not allow narco-terrorism or hostile foreign influence to threaten our security or our hemisphere, said Representative Juan Sisgumani, who represents southeastern Arizona in Congress. Weeks before the attack on Venezuela, Trump pardoned Juan Orlando Hernandez, the former president of Honduras, despite his being convicted on similar drug trafficking charges. The GOP lawmakers defended Trump's use of military force abroad, which will commit U.S. resources to another country at the time when the party's base has been skeptical of military entanglements overseas. This is peace through strength and action, defending our own backyard and stopping threats before they reach our borders, Hamade wrote. Biggs wrote that the operation was within President Trump's Article 2 executive authority, which designates the president as commander-in-chief of the U.S. military. The criminal charges and indictments against illegitimate dictator Maduro form the legal basis for this law enforcement operation with military protection, Biggs wrote. None of Arizona's GOP congressmen showed any signs of questioning the president's plan, though in the early afternoon of January 3rd, Representative Eli Crane had not yet commented on the situation publicly. Crane's office did not return requests for comment. The next article is titled, Gallego, Kelly Criticized Operation in Venezuela. This article was written by Ronald J. Hansen and Laura Gorsoni of the Arizona Republic. Arizona's U.S. Senator both condemned the pre-dawn military raid that brought Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro into American custody, although they did so in strikingly different ways. U.S. Senator Ruben Gallego, Democrat of Arizona, quickly waded into the January 3rd regime change with social media posts, describing the action as having no justification, and traded insults with his former political rival, Kerry Lake. By contrast, Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, who has faced threat of military judicial action for urging U.S. troops to refuse illegal orders, issued a statement as President Donald Trump wrapped up a news conference at his Mar-a-Lago residence. The President of the United States just overthrew a foreign ruler and explained to the American people that this is about taking control of the oil reserves of a foreign nation. He said that the U.S. will run the country until a proper transition can take place and went right into how U.S. oil companies will benefit from this takeover, Kelly said. He doesn't understand the risks and costs involved with those poorly thought through decisions that don't make Americans any safer today than they were yesterday. Nicolas Maduro is a brutal, illegitimate dictator who deserves to face justice. I want the people of Venezuela to be free to choose their own future, but if we learned anything from the Iraq War, it's that dropping bombs or toppling a leader doesn't guarantee democracy, stability, or make Americans safer. More often, it leads to chaos or drags the U.S. into a war and lengthy occupation. I don't trust that this administration has a plan, timeline, or price tag for what comes next, Kelly said. Gallego, in an official statement shortly after the raid, said, "There is no justification for the United States to be at war with Venezuela. I lived through the consequences of an illegal war sold to the American people with lies. We swore we would never repeat those mistakes, yet here we are again. The American people did not ask for this. Congress did not authorize this. And our service members should not be sent into harm's way for another unnecessary conflict. Gallego is a Marine combat veteran who served in Iraq. Kelly flew combat missions in the Gulf War as a U.S. Navy pilot. Both Democrats stuck notes similar to those and others in their party after the U.S.-led upheaval in Caracas. On his personal ex account, Gallego was even more pointed in his criticism. This war is illegal. It's embarrassing that we went from the world cop to the world bully in less than 1 year. There's no reason for us to be at war with Venezuela, he said. He pointed to a social media post from Representative Thomas Massey, Republican of Kentucky, who noted that the U.S. indictment of Maduro made no mention of fentanyl or stolen oil. Gallego asked who would run Venezuela hours before Trump declared, "We are going to run the country." Lake, who dismantled the Voice of America for Trump and has worked in an unclear role from an office at the State Department, sniped at Gallego after he said, "We are in the wrong for starting this war in Venezuela. You are part of member of a Mexican cartel family," she wrote in a garbled social media post that presumably referenced the criminal past of Gallego's estranged father. "You are a fraud. No one is surprised by your take." Gallego responded with a garbled political bob of his own. "I'm a U.S. Marine combat veteran that saw his best friends die because of bootleggers like you," he wrote. This line of attack is exactly why you lost by most of GOP candidates in 2024. Gallego defeated Lake in Arizona's November 2024 election for Senate. Gallego offered a snide rejoinder to El Salvador's President Nayib Bukele on X as well. Bukele, a Trump ally in Central America whose country has warehoused many deportees during the second Trump administration, sarcastically denigrated Senator Chris Van Hollen, Democrat of Maryland, who was critical of the U.S. actions. "So you just want to defend thugs," Bukele wrote in response to Van Hollen's view that was an illegal act of war. Gallego responded to Bukele saying, "So if the next president of the United States executes a warrant to extradite you to the United States using Delta Force, you would be okay with that." Kelly said the use of force in Venezuela showed the skill of the military action and the chaotic foreign policy of the Trump administration. "Over the past year, Trump's foreign policy has been reckless, chaotic, self-serving, and unconstitutional. Congress should vote this week to reassert its authority on behalf of the American people before he oversteps again. I also want to recognize the professionalism and skill of the American service members involved in this operation. While I don't agree with the administration's justification for this, I'm thankful that no service members were killed or seriously injured." Kelly is a member of the Senate Intelligence and Armed Services Committees who figured prominently in a Democratic video urging U.S. military personnel to refuse illegal orders, though the video didn't spell out what orders they had in mind. The Pentagon's strikes on boats carrying suspended drug couriers became a flashpoint over the use of military force in international waters. The Pentagon responded to the video by targeting Kelly, a former Navy combat pilot in particular. He has faced a review by the Navy for possible court-martial over his remarks. It remained unclear whether War Secretary Pete Hegseth would take any further steps on the matter. Arizona's House Democrats were similarly critical of Trump's actions. Representative Adelita Grijalva, a Tucson Democrat, cast the attack as driven by greed. "Let's be honest about what this is really all about: power, regime change, and oil and minerals," she said in a statement. "We have seen this playbook before in Latin America and elsewhere, and we have paid the price for it. When are we going to learn the lessons of our own history?" Representative Greg Stanton, Democrat of Arizona, a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, said Trump's actions effectively give license for unwanted aggression by others. "We cannot let U.S. foreign policy serve as a green light for authoritarians around the world who seek to dominate their own neighbors by force, especially countries like Russia and China," he said. Representative Yasemin Ansari, Democrat of Arizona, cited what she saw as a shifting rationale for targeting Caracas. Trump's explanation for this action have incredibly changed from combating drug trafficking to forcing regime change to now taking Venezuelan oil for the profit of multi-billion dollar oil conglomerates, he said. She predicted on social media that some of Trump's besties in the oil and gas industries are about to get distinguishingly rich while everyday Americans can't afford rent. The next article is titled Tucson's Retail Divide. This article was written by Adam Perlman of Arizona Sonoran News. Tucson's real estate market is splitting in two, with new development in affluent outlying areas commanding nearly double the rents of established shopping centers closer to the city core. The divide helps explain why two of the industry's largest national research firms released seemingly contradictory reports this fall. CBRE found Tucson rents falling 2.7% year over year. Cushman and Wakefield found them climbing 4.8%. The difference comes down to methodology. CBRE surveys shopping centers of 30,000 square feet or larger, while Cushman & Wakefield draws from CoStar data covering retail properties of all sizes. Both are accurate snapshots of different workers, or rather of different segments of a market that no longer moves as one. Rob Tomlinson, a principal in the retail division at Cushman & Wakefield, PICOR, cautioned against reading too much into market-wide averages. It's mediocre statistic, Tomlinson said of the aggregate rent figure. There is such a disparity in retail rates based upon size, location, quality, date of construction, traffic counts, demographics, all those sorts of things. The geographic split is stark. According to Tomlinson, outlying Tucson areas in the southeast, southwest, and northwest, particularly Oro Valley, can command rents approaching $40 per square foot. Midtown and the east and west sides hover closer to $20. That gap means a retailer leasing identical space could pay twice as much depending on location. The real bifurcation in retail is the second-generation space in established centers, Tomlinson said, referring to older buildings that have already had previous tenants. Those rental rates are very static. In contrast, he noted that new development in affluent areas can support rents that are almost twice as much. Cushman & Wakefield data shows the Northwest submarket posted a vacancy rate of just 2.5% in the third quarter, meaning almost all available space is leased. Central areas registered 8.3%, with nearly 1 in 10 storefronts sitting empty. Small retail spaces are in especially high demand. Vacancy for shop spaces under 4,000 square feet is at 2.1%, according to Cushman & Wakefield, leaving landlords with limited inventory for tenants seeking space in high-traffic locations. Service-oriented tenants are driving much of that demand. Both reports cite recent deals from auto parts retailer O'Reilly and Western wear chain Boot Barn, but the broader leasing activity comes from tenants migrating out of traditional office buildings. It's definitely service and entertainment, Tomlinson said. Medical services, financial services, fitness-oriented uses. We're seeing a lot of migration of medical out of traditional medical office environments and into retail environments. Places that are single-story have easy parking, surrounded amenities, and high foot traffic. These tenants often pay more than the traditional retailers they're replacing, which helps explain the rent growth showing up in surveys that capture smaller spaces. New construction remains limited. Elevated interest rates and building costs have made it difficult for developers to justify breaking ground without a tenant already signed. CBRE reports just one major project in the pipeline, a Bass Pro Shops at Marketplace at the Bridges, due to open in 2026. That supply constraint could tighten conditions further in segments already showing strength. I see sharply lower vacancy rates and increased rents, Tomlinson said of his 2026 outlook. I see a lot more investment sales, particularly for unanchored strip centers. Those are smaller retail strips without a major anchor tenant like a grocery store, and I see almost no speculative new development. And now several important news articles from around the nation and the world. First item is titled, How the U.S. Captured Maduro. This article was written by Meg Kennard of the Associated Press, Dateline Washington. For months, the U.S. military had been amassing a presence off Venezuela coast and conspicuously blowing up alleged drug trafficking boats and killing the occupants. At the same time, U.S. intelligence agencies were carefully studying the country's authoritarian president, Nicolas Maduro, learning minute details such as his eating habits, while special forces secretly rehearsed a plan to forcibly remove him. Months of covert planning led to the brazen operation overnight when President Donald Trump gave an order authorizing Maduro's capture. The U.S. plunged the South American country's capital into darkness, infiltrated Maduro's home, and whisked him to the United States, where the Trump administration planned to put him on trial. Trump, during a news conference Saturday at his Florida home, laid out details of the strike, after which he said Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, were flown by helicopter to a U.S. warship. The operation, termed Absolute Resolve, unfolded under the cover of darkness, with U.S. forces holding fast in the region, awaiting the ideal weather conditions to give pilots clear routes into Caracas. The extensive planning included practice on a replica of the presidential compound, as well as U.S. service members armed with what Trump said were massive blowtorches in the event the steel walls of a safe room needed to be cut open to extract the pair. He didn't get that space closed. He was trying to get into it, but he got bum-rushed right so fast that he didn't get into that. Trump said in an interview earlier Saturday morning on Fox and Friends Weekend. General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said at Trump's news conference that U.S. forces had rehearsed their maneuvers for months, learning everything about Maduro, where he was at certain hours, as well as details of his pets and the clothes he wore. I think we develop, we train, we rehearse, we debrief, we rehearse again and again, Kane said, saying his forces were set by early December not to get it right, but to ensure that we didn't get it wrong. Trump said on Fox that U.S. forces had practiced their extraction on the replica building. They actually built a house which was identical to the one they went into. All the same, all that steel all over the place, Trump said. Trump said in the television interview that U.S. forces held off conducting the operation for days, waiting 4 days for cloud cover to pass. Kane said that on Friday night, the weather broke just enough, clearing a path that only the most skilled aviators in the world could move through, adding that helicopters flew low to the water to enter Venezuela and were covered above by protective U.S. aircraft. Trump said the U.S. operation was dark and it was deadly, adding that the lights of Caracas were largely turned off due to a certain expertise that we have, but giving no further details. The attack, which Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth described as part of a massive joint military and law enforcement raid, lasted less than 30 minutes. At least 7 explosions were heard in Caracas, and Venezuela's Vice President Delcy Rodriguez, who under law takes power, said some Venezuelan civilians and members of the military were killed. In a televised address later sent sadly on state television, she demanded that the U.S. free Maduro and called him the country's rightful leader. But Rodriguez also left open the door for dialogue with the U.S. when she said, "We are willing to have respectful relations." Yanir Lucas, a Caracas resident whose house sits pressed up next to a Venezuela military base struck overnight, said she began to hear explosions next to her house around 1:50 in the morning. Trump said that a few U.S. members in the operation were injured, but he believed no one was killed. Kane said one helicopter was struck by fire as it closed in on Maduro's compound, but it was able to safely fly on its return. Trump said Maduro and Flores were flown by helicopter to a U.S. warship and would go on to New York to face charges. he posted on Truth Social a photo of the Venezuelan leader wearing a gray sweatsuit, protective headphones, and blindfold. The raid was a dramatic escalation from a series of strikes the U.S. military has carried out on what Trump has said were drug-carrying boats on the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific Ocean since early September. On December 29th, Trump said the U.S. struck a facility where boats accused of carrying drugs load up. The CIA was behind the drone strike at a docking area believed to have been by Venezuelan drug cartels, the first known direct operation on Venezuelan soil since the U.S. began its strikes in September. Though Trump had warned for months that the U.S. might conduct strikes in Venezuela, he gave little hint on Friday that what was coming. He spent the morning posting on social media defending his health and complaining about the impact of the wind turbines on birds before he went shopping for marble and onyx for the ballroom he's building at the White House and a visit to his golf club. Privately, he was readying to give the go-ahead for a military mission that already had generated criticism in the U.S. and abroad. Now the president said the U.S. will direct a path forward for Venezuela as questions have emerged about the legality of those plans and Maduro's capture. Trump said at his news conference that the group of officials standing behind him, including Hegseth, Kane, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, will be a team that's working with the people of Venezuela. The Republican president left open the possibility that U.S. troops would have a presence in the country. "We're not afraid of boots on the ground if we have to," he said, adding, "We had boots on the ground last night." "The U.S. will now run the country until a new leader can be chosen," Trump said. "We're going to make sure that the country is run properly. We're not doing this in vain," he said. "This is a very dangerous attack. This is an attack that could have gone very, very badly." Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the January 5th, 2026 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.